No cheese, Gromit.
In honor of Aardman Animation's early man, even though we quoted Wallace and Gromit, what's the best work of stop-motion animation? Either a sequence, a special effect, short, or feature-length work? It could be anything.
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with maybe not the best, but the thing that has stuck in my mind the most since I watched it in sixth grade, which is the harpies befouling the food, I think is the term, in Jason and the Argonauts.
I'm Matt Patches, and really the answer is Wallace and Gromit, but I'm going to pick something else. And I'm going to pick Large Marge and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Ah!
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I am going to go with the entirety of Kubo and the Two Strings. Whatever your thoughts on that movie, I don't think I've ever seen more incredible artistry done with stop motion.
I cannot believe
you did not. Mr. Fox.
I mean, Fantastic Mr. Fox is my favorite stop motion film, but it's not the best use of stop motion.
Oh my God, are you tempting me here?
I'm not doing a favorite versus best qualitatively sort of thing. I'm just saying that
we're doing quality of animation versus quality.
I see.
I think that's fair.
Score. It's the Olympics of stop motion.
Yeah. Is Sean White gonna pull it off? I don't know.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 202 and it's Wednesday, February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day. And also on this day in history, in 1938, Hedda Hopper's first column appeared in the Los Angeles Times.
Fuck Hedda Hopper. 2 years ago on this day in history, I got engaged to the love of my life.
You had the chance to fill out the doc with on this day of history. Mr. Shot.
Like my engagement, this announcement here was a surprise.
Who cares about your engagement anniversary? You got married.
Hedda Hopper
now celebrate that. That wipes your engagement anniversary off the calendar, as far as I'm concerned.
It's true. It's true. Getting married does.
Do you feel the need to celebrate Valentine's Day as a result of this?
I will be leaving the continent tomorrow on Valentine's Day. I know, still very much in the part of my marriage, which hopefully lasts forever, where I get intensely sad to leave my wife for even 5 or 6 days. So I am sad about it. But
I'm in the same boat. I'm celebrating Valentine's Day by wearing a viral mask to avoid spreading the flu to my 1-year-old child and wife. I love who I
You don't
want
to go viral in your house?
We're going viral.
I am celebrating Valentine's Day by driving to two different places to try to get candy that was appropriate to have my toddler give to his classmates at daycare because they give out Valentine's and Valentine's candy, which I didn't know about till last week.
Wow.
It all seems incredibly stupid.
Romance does not die when you get older, listeners. It only becomes stronger, just like in the movies.
I was going to say speaking of movies, but I don't know if I have a good segue. Dave Gonzalez is not with us at this moment, but he will be joining us because we'll be talking about Black Panther, and we were not going to let him miss that. But yeah, he'll be here later. First, we're going to talk about some other stuff.
And?
Oh, do we have reviews?
Reviews?
Yeah.
More surprises from David.
Great planning
surprises.
On this episode.
You should assume. Have faith in our listeners.
The
please.
Wheels well, fall off of this thing entirely when Dave isn't here.
We have two reviews. The first from Sonkiki says, really good movie chat. The hosts are very clever, fun, and entertaining. And even though I don't get all the cross-references to other movies, I don't even watch most of the new stuff, to be honest. It's just so nice to listen to you talk. I think it's fun and entertaining to listen to their informed banter about stuff I know very little about. I really learned a thing or two about the movie industry and about the different way film critics approach their work. Thanks, guys.
That was lovely.
Well, yeah, that was very. It was lovely and helpful.
Yes.
We also have a review from Rebecca Zubs, who says, "Listen, as a lesbian with a tattoo of the words 'flung out of space' tattooed on her collarbone, I'm allowed to say that this is the Carol of movie podcasts." Okay.
Whoa.
Okay. This review was very helpful, also evocative. I'm curious what that looks like.
David, without a Carol tattoo, are you a true Carol fan?
Yeah, I think my fandom can only go to a certain point. Uh, Okay, so for our first segment tonight, we're going to be talking about a film that all of yous, who are at least all of yous who are willing to spend $2 or $3 or $4 on renting movies.
$5. You got to see it in HD.
Of course. Although with this film, who knows?
Not sure about
that. Is a movie that all of you can watch right now. It's called Flames by Josephine Decker and Zephyr Throell, although the by credit is kind of complicated. But
it's actually directed by Zephyr Throell.
Technically directed by Zephyr Throell.
Directed a long time by right. Josephine Decker.
Right, yeah, we'll get into that. But Josephine Decker is a name that if you listen to this podcast or follow film, you might know because she was recently, at least to my mind, the talk of Sundance with the best film there, Madeline's Madeline, which she directed and wrote. And Zephyr Throell is her ex-boyfriend and also a performance artist. And in 2011, when they were dating, this couple, which makes a certain amount of sense for this particular couple, decided to film their relationship. It was originally supposed to be just a little project for the MoMA. The MoMA said to Zephyr, and he is such a Zephyr, by the way, if ever you met one, that they would pretty much produce anything that he wanted to make. And so this is what he came up with. And they began recreating some very recent episodes from their life. One that is very early in the movie involving the condom coming off when he had sex with her. And the first time that they had sex, actually. And she yelling at him about killing their baby. What's that?
These are recreations. They're not explicitly recreations. I haven't read anything about this movie, but I have watched it, so I'm interested.
Yeah. I'm just setting up the experience of watching it.
Is that it is purporting to be.
Yeah, I'm doing a poor job of this. It is. Matt is absolutely right. Yeah, the setup is that it is all very real, and the very first scene of the movie is them having unsimulated sex, or is. Zephyr pointed out when I spoke to him on the phone the other day, just sex, which is what unsimulated sex would be in the natural world.
Is it like explicit the way that you think of unsimulated sex when you talk about movies? Or
no, it's like intimate and jokey, and he's like they're laughing, and he's doing he's in sort of a strange pose, and then the next scene is them playing sock puppets under the cover, and even that
scenes of them having sex. Actually.
But yeah, no, there are multiple. I mean, it's clearly unsimulated, but I think they use that as a device to sort of sell you on reality as being the default mode of this film, so that you're always thinking about the scenes that are more obviously faked as being in relation to reality rather than the opposite way around, where you're like, oh, this is faked, but wait, this scene sort of looks real. So they do this, and then they decide after the MoMA show – none of this is in the movie. I mean, the MoMA show stuff, it's all just presented as though you're watching home video footage from someone's relationship. They go to the Maldives, this place called Danger Island, because
– no, they don't get to Danger Island.
Well, they don't get to Danger Island, but
they close
their eyes, right, and throw a dart at a map on the ceiling and decide where to go wherever it lands. And it lands at a place called Danger Island off the Maldives. So they take
white privilege airlines to
and he keeps making the movie for 5 more years, constantly sort of cajoling Josephine Decker into meeting up with him and catching up and even going to couples therapy while they're both dating other people. And it is a really, really interesting, crazy experience.
He sounds awful. Convince me that I actually want to spend time with this movie.
That's a complicated question. David, I'm kind of waiting to see you weigh in on the movie if you thought it was good, which I don't know if that's the way to categorize this movie. As we explained, these are two artists, and I think that Flames is authentic art. I don't think it's documentary film.
No.
I think it's a lot of, recreation and them bringing performance to each of these kind of staged moments that they're playing for reality. And then that is kind of the point of the movie. They can't stop performing. They can't stop being artists. And there's some interesting ideas behind that may have been the reason their real relationship imploded.
Yes, the idea that the process of documenting the relationship ended up being the death of the relationship.
So there's some interesting ideas going on here. But I think the movie, even though I believe it is authentic art, I think it is failed drama. I don't think it actually gets to explore these ideas very well because these two end up coming off, especially him, especially Zephyr, comes off as such an asshole and such a kind of privileged person in the art space, that he is so obsessed with creating artistic moments out of real life that he starts manufacturing them, and beyond the scope that he knows he's manufacturing them within the film. That sounds, is that like two?
No,
like two layers of meta removal. And the reason the movie doesn't work is because he thinks he's one layer removed. And I do think they're like white, and this is not a critique that I usually like dwell on, but I do think they're like white privilege interferes with this movie. They take this trip to the Maldives and they joke about like missing a revolution because they were hanging out at the beach, but like they were, and they don't seem to understand the culture around them.
It's not necessarily a joke. Right. It's what happened, right? They're on their flight back watching Transformers and they learn that there was a revolution in the Maldives.
But I think that they think they're in on the joke or something. Like, it's just not disconnecting. And then there's a later scene where Zephyr has this art project where they're doing strip poker in the middle of it's kind of on the border of like Chinatown and Wall Street.
Yeah, it was right before Occupy Wall Street. It was like a week before the Occupy Wall Street really started.
But they're like right on Canal Street. So if you know New York, this is where all the like metal shops and stuff are. So this is still kind of Chinatown. And all these, you know, white people, intelligentsia, are like stripping off clothes in the middle of the street and playing strip poker. And both of them Josephine gets really uncomfortable at some point taking off her clothes because all of these men are taking pictures of her. Now, there's an interesting idea there because she feels like he's pushing her into this scenario and it's abusive and it is. But then there's this other layer that I can't tell if the movie is really grappling with, the fact that it's like all these white people staging this thing and there's a lot of like Chinese men around. And that just felt like a weird removal. Like, I felt like their commentary on that, and she's growling at them. There's this strange disconnect in the way that this movie thinks it's communicating about everyday people, but it's really communicating about class and their ability to make this movie with their relationships and have these conversations about art. It didn't quite get to me. There's definitely some affecting stuff when like he's yelling at her and you're seeing their relationship break down. That seems interesting, but this is really just like keeping up with the Kardashians for the film Twitter crowd and a failure for me. But it's kind of like, actually, I was also thinking maybe like Mumblecore Phantom Thread.
I don't follow you on the race stuff at all in this particular movie. I mean, I do think you're not wrong that there's a certain amount of white privilege in what they're doing. I just don't I don't see it quite as much, first of all,
certain scenes in the
Occupy Wall Street stuff. I also don't see it as a detriment to the movie, because this is nothing if not a very self-aware film. But my take on the movie, I think, is a little bit more generous overall than yours. I do think that it doesn't quite work as drama because, you know, he is working alone and piecing the movie together for years after they broke up. And the most interesting scenes there are when he brings her into the editing room and shows her the footage and they comment on it. And I think that is a really interesting layer. But I think, you know, what I really got out of it is in not too dissimilar from something like Certified Copy, is this idea of the performative nature of romance being a relationship, and how, and I was speaking to both of them on the phone, and they have a really interesting dynamic. They're so open together. I mean, they've been broken up for years. They're both with other people. I was on a conference call with them, and they're still as candid and forthcoming.
But how do you take that seriously? Because even in the film, she's like, what are we acting now? Like,
she's
in the most authentic moment in the movie, Josephine is questioning whether the moment they're having is being filmed.
Genuinely uncomfortable through a lot of this and very vulnerable, obviously. And he recognizes that he was being a bit of an asshole. And I think it's been really hard for him to make the movie because he's constantly looking at footage of him being a schmuck and he's reckoning with that. But so much of, I think, what they vibe on together and what they enjoy as a couple and what I think brought them together is this idea of art and pain. And I mean, like, so often today, the way we talk about art, we try to disentangle it from pain as much as we can. And they are very much about art being a mechanism to work through pain and about like using art and pain together. Oh, Shaun White did it. Yay. Good for him. I think that, like, the movie, it's really interesting to see him push himself through that and come out on the other side. And for me, talking to them about this and thinking about my own life, I'm just thinking how much, like, I was never truly happy in the way that I am now romantically until you get to a point where you no longer are asking yourself these questions about performance or reality, because whatever sort of
accord that you come to is just comfortable. You don't have to question it. You don't have to look at your partner and think that you're putting on a show for them and so forth. And I think like all the questioning is, was this real? Was this performative? Is to get to a place where you don't feel the need to ask yourself those questions. And so as a movie about that and getting there, I mean, using all the tools of their various media to do so, and all about the process of making something, which is sort of what Madeline is about, which you guys will see later, about the process of making something rather being that being the emphasis rather than results. I thought it was really, really interesting in that regard.
Do you think
and
that he comes
90 minutes
to an
very
understanding
well
in the film, or do you think that he?
No, I think that if
does
you
he have a personal revelation.
I don't know if it's in the text of the movie that he comes to some sort of understanding. I mean, it's a very loopy, semi-linear slipstream of a film by design, but it gets you close enough that. I don't know, if you went on IndieWire and read an interview about them, for example, you'd be able to...
The reason I ask is because in the end of the movie, even though he's kind of reconciled with her and he seems to understand that his art and his obsession with performance and his intoxication has damaged their relationship, has abused a woman, it seems like, in his life. That's what I was taking away from it. He comes to reconciliation with her about this, and yet... Throughout the movie, and in the very last scene, I think he is still like naming this other woman he's dated. I won't name her, but I guess if you want to watch the movie,
he's still dating her in real life.
He's dating Sarah Chips, the psychologist.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just gonna name her then.
Sarah Chips, the psychologist,
because you could go find her. Like, I just think that's so weird to name drop her in full over and over in this movie when you're talking about like sucking a woman into your life and damaging her through your art.
That,
he continues
to
abuse his current girlfriend, apparently, by name dropping. Of course, the first thing I did was Google her. But she's a psychologist.
A terrible term to use in this context. I think you have no grounds for using that word.
I'm just saying it's a slippery slope for him.
There's ample opportunity in this movie for emotional abuse, and I think that he would probably admit that he submitted Josephine to plenty of it. And there's all obviously issues of consent, not physical consent, but consent of image and narrative. And these are all things that she and he have reckoned with, and that it was really sort of an interesting point of comparison to all the conversations we're having in culture right now, to see a movie where two people went through this process, not of a physical nature. It's no rape, it's no sexual assault or anything like that. But his work is often very sexual and is meant to be provocative and raise those questions. But to see them come out on the other side like this and be so sort of grounded about talking about these things was interesting. But I think, you know, to the Sarah Chips point, you don't get into a relationship with somebody like Zephyr Terwell if you're going to be break up with him because he makes this movie, you know, for years on end.
She did participate in the strip poker.
And this is what Josephine says when I talked to her, is that she was like, you know, all these things when you're looking at the movie and saying that, you know, he was sort of emotionally abusive or narcissistic and so on are true, but I agreed to be part of this, which is not, you know, you can't conflate that to like the more grave issues that we talk about, sexual assault and whatnot, just in the context of this experiment.
I'm not either.
I'm just saying just in the context of this experiment, she agreed to let him make the movie, to let him continue to make the movie rather than insisting that they bury the footage afterwards. And so like she really owned that process because she recognized that he was working through something just in the same way that she would need to work through something in her own art. And that's a really interesting dynamic.
It's art. It Flames is an art movie, and it is authentic art. It's just a failure for me, but maybe people should watch it anyway.
Flames. It's on iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, all that shit.
Dave's here. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going?
Good to have you. You're here just in time for us to talk to you about the thing that I assume all Coloradans do, which is watch the Winter Olympics because you live on a ski lift.
Mm.
What happens in Colorado, I think. Just for a mini segment, what are you watching at the Olympics?
I had to Google where the Olympics were taking place yesterday because I figured out they were happening. Apparently, there is a gay figure skater who, as everybody all the Twitter and a nearly
that's two, one way of putting it.
Two nearly flawless snowboard runs for America. And then I understand that we've just, as we've been recording this, won our 100th gold medal for a person I've seen more talk about whether or not we should be talking about his sexual harassment accusations than I have about his Olympic performance. So I might not have been the best person to start this segment on, because my answer is I'm just as engaged with sports as I have been the rest of the year.
You know what? I like consistency.
Yeah, you know, that you could always depend on the sun setting, and Dave is not watching the sport.
How have we won 100 gold medals already?
I feel like 100.
No,
100
gold medals ever in the Winter Olympics.
Oh,
this is our 100th gold medal ever.
I'm even a bad sports journalist.
It's crazy how many fewer Olympics there are, just period, in Winter Olympics. Summer Olympics, you win 100 like every year.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, David, you interrupted the last segment to talk about Shaun White. What you been watching in the Olympics?
Not too much. I just watched, I watched Chloe Kim, and I watched, the girl whose name I can't remember, do the triple axel.
Yeah.
But I should remember her name.
Mirai Nagusu?
She was the most, it was something I found really interesting about her. I mean, I'm always fascinated by the non-Shaun Whites and the Chloe Kims who have these huge endorsement deals. I'm fascinated by the Olympians who, are working full-time jobs in complete anonymity and then become massively famous for two weeks, and now it's for like one news cycle, and then fade back into obscurity for another 4 years and have to go back to these sort of blue-collar lives. And it's very strange that America, I don't know, very American, we sort of use them for a little bit and run away with them, and I'm not saying they all need to be.
That's not an American thing. That's all of Olympics, right? That's all Olympians are like that.
No, I mean, I just feel like the Olympians. I'm pulling this out of my ass. It's kind of conjecture, but I feel like a lot of the other countries, the smaller countries that have more centralized sort of cultural spheres, certainly in the sports world, elevate these celebrities to a higher status where they don't, or these athletes rather, to a higher status. I mean, I don't know what they would do. I'm just more interested in it and what that. What that whiplash must be like for the celebrities. I'm not taking it as like a moral stand necessarily. But the ice skater did the triple axel before she was in the Olympics. She was an ice girl, one of the ice girls for the Colorado Avalanche hockey team. She would go out there and this is something that a lot of the newer teams have, but like a dignified team like the New York Rangers does not, where they have girls in skimpy outfits go out to the ice and, move some shovels around and throw out t-shirts.
We have our own, Hooters that's mountain-based. It's called Twin Peaks.
Yeah. I mean, hey, great work if you can get it. But I just thought it was really cool that she was involved in the NHL in any capacity. And then, went on to become, I believe, the first American woman to land a triple axel in Olympic competition.
I believe that's true. Tanya Harding once tried it.
Yeah.
This woman pulled it off.
I imagine that the documentary about... I have to look up her name. It's terribly rude of me that I don't know her.
Pat just said it. It's Mirai Nagusu.
Mirai Nagusu. I'm not usually one to trust Patch's pronunciation.
David doesn't hear my voice.
No, I do. I just don't. I don't want to repeat pronunciations that you say.
Pronunciation, I can't promise. I said that.
Mirai Nagusu, if that is to be her name. I thought her stuff was cool. But it still feels like early days in the Olympics, right? I mean, there's a lot to go.
Yeah. Wait, with Patches, what have you been into?
Well, I watched the female... was it the slope style one? No, the half pipe. The women's half pipe snowboarding.
That was the Chloe Kim.
Just destroyed. I mean... I can't remember the other American girl's name who got bounced out of the
gold, right?
The top rankings. There was some 17-year-old girl. It was so sad. It was like, oh man, she was so close. She'll be back in the she'll be back for the 22 Winter Olympics when she's 21. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, I don't
Chloe
feel
Kim's
so bad
in high
anymore.
School.
Yeah, but
she's
Chloe
in high
Kim
school.
Is 17 as well, and she was just. A killer. I mean,
Tara Lipinski was 14. I mean, we put things in perspective, which is crazy.
It's crazy.
But it made me think, like, how early do you have to get on board? You have to be destined to be an Olympic athlete, right? You have to, your parents have to decide you're going to do it. I was, I'm looking at my newborn daughter. I'm looking at Chloe Kim kill it on the half pipe. And I'm just thinking, if I don't put you on a board right now, you would never be able to do this.
Well, it's searching
for
Bobby Fischer,
you have to dedicate
right?
your entire life to it.
They move across the country. Like, I was reading about the Shib Sibs, the ice dancing pair from America, and, like, they grew up in Connecticut and Massachusetts, and they moved to several different states to go train with the right ice dancing coach. Like, it's your family's whole life.
There's a darkness to all this. I mean, I was thinking about Molly's Game a little bit. And I started off as, what was she?
She was a ski
jumper?
Skier.
Yeah, she was a downhill
slalom or whatever. But, you know, her dad was so aggressive about committing to practice and being perfect. But I mean, that's what you have to do to get here. And I don't know. There's a certain sadness to that as well. But I'm very happy for everybody who won. And I also watched the men's luge a few nights ago, where the greatest line in television history was uttered. The luge world will be speechless because Felix Locke, Germany's luge guy, was supposed to just destroy everyone. And in his final run, totally effed up. And the U.S. got its first men's luge gold, or not gold, but got snuck in there with a medal. So that was cool.
To close things out, I want to talk about the guy who Dave hinted at, Adam Rippon, who is the gay figure skater who people are very excited about. And I am I'm not even like an every 4 years figure skating expert. Like, I remember to tune in, but I enjoy watching it and I enjoy how the characters get built because that's what everyone gets most excited about. And if you haven't read it, my colleague Richard Lawson wrote a piece about Adam Rippon and about like his what he means for gay people specifically.
Yeah, it was
wonderful.
It's
really interesting. It's really lovely, like, personal piece. And I think, like, his figure skating routine, which was to Coldplay, but, like, very beautiful instrumental Coldplay, was just a really amazing thing to behold. It's the kind of thing that if you don't know figure skating, you can watch it and be like, oh, I get why people freak out about this. And then his presence, like, giving interviews and, you know, like, eye rolls and just talking like a very clearly gay man, which for all of the, like, ways that you think of figure skating as being a girly thing, and you know, straight male figure skaters talk about how they were like gay bashed because of the sport. He's kind of revolutionary in that sport all the same, and I like the context of what he means, and then also watching him skate.
He's gonna be everywhere.
Yeah, well, right? He's also 28 though, so like this is really his last.
He's gonna be everywhere. He can milkshake duck real fast.
He could milkshake duck, or he's just going to be a TV commentator. And I mean, he's going to be like Tim Tebow, who had like one flash in the pan athletic accomplishment, and he'll just be on television forever.
Ooh,
which
fourth,
is fine.
I saw someone else
when American Idol starts to fail this summer.
No, see, it's not going to be American. No, he's got to be. I saw someone else tweet this, and having been keeping up with Drag Race All Star 3 this season, I could say he's got Adam Rippon must be. A drag race judge.
That seems
just be so perfect.
That seems extremely possible.
Yes, that seems very likely.
Heavy words, little lies, telling everything but the truth. The truth. Three little words over time.
The event we've all been waiting for. It's been 3 months, so it's time to talk about another Marvel movie on this podcast. This time, I've seen it. Guys, I saw my first Marvel movie in theaters since, I think, Civil War, which was exciting. I don't even remember how long ago that was. It's been a time.
Buffy was on television.
I was that kid in Iron Man 3. Anyway, we all saw Black Panther, which is the huge movie of February and maybe the year. The excitement around it is legit in a way, I think, even for those of us who, you know, every time a Marvel movie comes out, everyone's like, this is a great Marvel movie. It's different. But this one actually does feel different. And I was gonna, I guess, throw it to Dave to tell us what Black Panther is about. We're going to do non-spoiler section first, however briefly we need to do it. So if you haven't seen it yet, now is not the time to tune out. We will let you know. Dave, without getting too much into complicated things about what vibranium is, what's Black Panther about?
Well, if you guys remember Civil War, T'Chaka, the father of T'Challa, the current Black Panther in this movie, was blown up in a unrelated thing that you'd have to see Civil War to care about.
One of this movie's flaws is that it does ask you to remember what the fuck happened in Civil War.
There are flashbacks.
I wonder how
even then, I was like, come on.
For that one flash of his photograph at the beginning of this movie, to be like, remember him? Which I truly didn't. I did not remember that he was responsible for what happened in Civil War.
Captain America: Civil War was just an excuse to film lots of clips they could use as flashbacks or set
in Black Panther.
It really wasn't a movie.
There was an airport fight.
Cost-saving
there
operation.
There was a whole airport fight.
Which
anyway,
they reference in the Ant-Man.
They put that online.
So he comes back to Wakanda, the hidden tribe in Africa, or hidden nation in Africa, that thousands and thousands of years ago was given power of this thing called the heart-shaped herb to elect a Black Panther king who would protect the kingdom, which is sitting on a mountain of vibranium, which is a ancient asteroid that hit with this the most powerful and valuable metal in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the thing Captain America's shield's made out of, yada, yada, yada. That's the basic setup. He goes back to Wakanda. We get a basic idea that they've been isolationists this whole time. There are some people who agree with that and like that Wakanda has become technologically advanced while staying hidden from the world at large, who thinks they're a whole bunch of starving goat farmers. And
there's a strong suggestion that they're doing this. I'm very aware of colonialism and why there is a good reason to hide your good stuff from white people, which is interesting.
For sure. And it's also a generational decision. And this movie centers around T'Challa having to take on the mantle of the Black Panther, which is done through a ceremonial trial where one of the tribes tries to challenge him. And we get to see how T'Challa fights without his super suit and his powers from the heart-shaped herb. And then he gets to deal with the problems of being a king, which in this case involve Andy Serkis's Claw, who you saw in Avengers Age of Ultron, deals in vibranium.
Did we, though? like, that was another... I was like, Andy Serkis is fine in this movie, and Claw does his bit. But I was like, why you gotta remind us of Age of Ultron?
I honestly didn't remember. I knew I'd seen him before, but I did not remember which.
I know they planted.
But you don't need to remember.
No, you really don't.
They really do sort of, it feels now like they planted that completely extraneous subplot in Age of Ultron just so it could sort of be the foundation for this
year. Really? It feels like an accident they are able to work into this.
I mean, no, but they make it feel, they make it feel that deliberate. I mean, I think, you know, especially, yeah, whatever, it's fine. But I was like, this movie, one of its charms, I know Dave agrees because he said on Twitter, is that it is kind of self-contained relative to the rest of the MCU movies. And so things that tied it into the larger Marvel Universe were unappreciated. The Stan Lee cameo, for example, has never been more jarring or unwelcome.
Dave, do you feel like you set up the plot? Is there anything else we should get into? Sorry, I mean, Michael B. Jordan is in this movie. I think we said we were going to get mostly into his character later, but you see him early on in kind of in an art museum heist, and he starts establishing himself as the villain.
I mean, I will say that the basis of the conflict of the film is what role should Wakanda take in the greater world, considering their ideal technological nation that has mastered its own culture and is very aware that everybody else in the continent that they live on has been subjugated and has had part of that culture erased or wiped out by outsiders, or being turned against themselves, I guess would be the way I would sum up the rest of the plot without...
Well, we also haven't mentioned any of the women who are essential to the entire story.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that one of them in particular, who is played by Lupita Nyong'o, who is has some romantic history with T'Challa, is... T'Challa. I mean, the way it's spelled, I always just think Hala because, you know, always a Jewish Panther at heart. You know, in honor to the two Jews who created Black Panther back in the day. She is... one of the things I really like about this movie is that there is a little bit of moral ambiguity. I mean, the issues that they deal with are so much better dimensionalized and explored than the sort of civic debates that they have in something like Age of Ultron or Civil War. Lupita Nyong'o's character is very much a good guy and has Wakanda's interests at heart, but she is also an advocate of Wakanda opening up to the world and showing them what they've been able to accomplish and, you know, not just allowing people to look down on them or overlook them completely, you know, as they are hidden away from society. And she is not alone. Daniel Kaluuya plays another one, a leader of one of the five tribes of Wakanda, who is also in favor of expanding. And I thought that was really interesting dynamic. But the rest of the – it's the Dora Milaje. Is that what they're called?
The Warriors?
Yeah. Dave?
Yes.
Dave, what are they called?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they are – just to keep rolling with what Katie was saying, they are awesome. Why don't you, Katie? Because I was just reading a profile – it wasn't on Vanity Fair. I thought it was on Vanity Fair. It was actually Amy Nicholson in Rolling Stone about the actress who plays the head of the
Denai Guerrero is the woman.
She is phenomenal.
Yeah, she is phenomenal. Amazing. And Amy Nicholson wrote a great profile of her. Vanity Fair, Joanna Robinson, who everyone knows, wrote a profile of Letitia Wright, who is also amazing, who plays T'Challa's younger sister, Shuri, who is kind of the she's like Q in James Bond, and also his kid sister. And is there's a lot of people.
But she's
in
so much more exciting because she like is giddy and young and she cares.
Yeah, no, she is awesome. And there's a lot of people in this movie. Either like Daniel Kaluuya, who maybe you've seen a handful of times, or maybe Lupita Nyong'o, who you've seen in live action only a few times because she keeps making Star Wars movies. And then Letitia Wright, who I'd never seen before.
She made two Star Wars movies.
Yeah, but her career in live action film has been small.
She also played an animal in The Jungle Book.
She also played an animal in The Jungle Book.
That's a motion capture character. I just wanted to be very specific.
Anyway,
there's not as thing as too many Star Wars movies for Lupita Nyong'o at the moment.
Seeing Lupita Nyong'o's actual face was a real thrill in this. But anyway, so a lot of people who you're either discovering or seeing again for the first time, I mean, Angela Bassett, I just felt like I hadn't seen in like a good role in a while. So the cast in this is just like stacked to this crazy degree where I kept thinking I'd seen everybody who's in it, and then like Martin Freeman shows up or Forest Whitaker shows up. It's really fun.
Well, wait, can we just kind of back up?
Are we still doing plot? People,
yeah, no, not to the plot, but like you were talking about a lot of the micro elements that were. I mean, the movie is very performance driven. There are tons of characters, and the first half of the movie is a lot of like world building where you just get to hang out with them, and that was really fun. I was really excited to kind of explore Wakanda, and I've heard people, or I've read in reviews and seen people tweet. But they think the first act is really kind of slow.
They're wrong.
This was my favorite part. I'm just like, I love touring Wakanda. I love seeing the traditions and the way the Afrofuturism, how this city has grown in the years since the meteor fell, and how they built this technology and how they use it and how they hide and how they interact with the real world. All of this information was actually really rich and valuable to me. And to get to hang out with these characters and feel their relationships. I love the relationship between T'Challa and his sister. You were saying like she's a really giddy personality, but they have like it's not fake comedy. This is a real like brother sister relationship where they pick on each other and they're taking swipes.
It's the specificity, right? I mean, like that's why this movie is so good. I mean, there are so many reasons why this movie works and why it's going to connect with so many people. You know, particularly the very underserved Black audience. But I mean, it all comes down to specificity. And we talk all the time, or at least I rant all the time, about how Marvel movies come off an assembly line and they're so generic. But this is, I mean, Patches mentioned Afrofuturism. Like, this is a like unabashed Afrofuturistic film. It leads.
You
want to
give a quick definition of Afrofuturism? Because that's a term
I just did it for Star Wars. So traditionally, science fiction as we think about it, science fiction, but it's mostly the written word, which is going to lead to the question I'm going to ask at the end of this, is from a white male perspective. So when you think of the future, you're thinking like honestly a 60s version of the future, but even if you're keeping up with traditional literature, the majority of the time you're going to see white people projecting what they think the future is going to be, which is going to be inherently white. Afrofuturism is projecting Black people into the future, not just they survive, but that theirs is actually the culture that continues onward, technologically, just through time and in space. Patches, you might be able to help me out here because no one on Star Wars Spoilers was able to, the first Afrofuturist thing I ever read was The Ear, the Eye, and the Arm.
I love The Ear, the Eye, and the Arm, but although it was written by a white woman, so I always wonder if I should be celebrating it.
It's also a Newbery Award for young adults, but the point is that's
such a wonderful book.
It's a 23rd century Africa that's being portrayed in that book. And the question I asked on Storm of Spoilers and that I sort of came to a realization of when I was talking about it is this is the first time I've seen Afrofuturism. I've maybe seen like an illustration here or there or like read I'm just talking about me. I'm not talking about the world at large.
Well, no, I'm saying I think you have seen Afrofuturism in other mediums, especially music. I feel like,
but that's yeah, a lot that's of not seeing.
That's not seeing Afrofuturism.
Like, you know, Janelle Monáe in particular over the last few years.
Absolutely,
has
absolutely.
A lot of.
But sorry, go on.
Well, yeah,
and
I'm
also
like,
you've seen Gods of Egypt.
No, I haven't seen Gods of Egypt. So thank God. Of Egypt. But the point being is that it's so striking. A lot of what the early parts of this film that David was talking about that feels really like motivated, or I guess both patches of David were talking about it, is just seeing these things and getting the feeling that it's new, but not necessarily having to stop and have like a groundbreaking motion capture character, or have a, you know, Vista that twirls five times like Asgard. All we just get is just seeing this and being it being portrayed so authentically in a comic book movie. I don't know. It feels kinetically different when you're seeing something like Shuri's lab and how it's decorated than
but it
is
never feels...
watching Tony Stark go through five different CG things.
Right, because it's not just there to look cool. I mean, like, none of this stuff ever just feels cosmetic. It is rooted in character, and the characters are rooted in place and in a certain history, and in an identity that's fully realized. And because of that, as I wrote in my review, I mean, it's not just... I mean, I can only relate so far watching this movie as to what it feels to be represented as a black audience, but I don't think it's just the first Marvel film in which black people can see themselves. I think it's the first Marvel movie in which almost anyone can see themselves, if it, you know, is particularly geared towards a black audience here, because it's the first time that it's a Marvel movie has actually treated its characters, and who they are and where they come from with this degree of respect. It pays off in a beautifully, you know, for the most part, a beautifully told movie with characters who feel real and alive. And a world that feels alive, even if it's all shot in the same fucking soundstage in Georgia where they shoot all this shit.
Yeah, it's interesting how everyone, each of the characters, even like, you know, Forrest Whitaker appears as a kind of Wakandan elder who's in charge of the heart-shaped herb that Dave was talking about. And, you know, he doesn't have that much screen time, but his beats are so lived in and deep. Like, he seems very connected to the Wakandan traditions, and you believe that they're real. Or like Angela Bassett. You know, I
everything
think she
he's
maybe
missing
three or four
in,
scenes.
Everything Forrest Whitaker is missing in Rogue One, he brings to Black Panther,
yeah.
Which
yeah,
is
true.
Really interesting.
Or like
Forrest Whitaker's making those Disney bucks.
This great character. So the Wakandan nation is kind of split up into different tribes, and one has gone to the mountains and has turned their back to the rest of the tribes, and they're more war driven. And this actor Winston Duke, I believe, plays the leader of that tribe.
He's so great.
He fights T'Challa really early, and he is he's hilarious. He's aggressive. The physicality is there. I just like, and this character comes to life kind of out of nowhere. He could easily be the disposable red shirt from the beginning to show how impressive T'Challa is. But it's am I saying T'Challa?
T'Challa.
But I do think that like all with all these great characters, all these things just made me wish that the film was an out and out drama. That it was really just sort of a more of a political thing about vying for power in Wakanda, about the future of Wakanda, about what it means
here's what's crazy.
Country that has been sort of grown in the image of colonialism and has tried to escape that as best it could, dealing with a modern world.
I think this is where we'll start dividing, because I think we had talked a little bit when you first saw it, David, and I want to talk about the action in this movie soon.
Which is god-awful.
So you think it's god awful. I actually think it's pretty good for a majority of the movie. I think the early fights are not like Creed level, you know, visceral, but that first fight
close.
He has in the water with M'Baku, the other tribe leader, is really cool. On the edge of the cliff, the matte painting scenes, they work. Like, you're really in that place, and all the costuming, all the tribes coming together,
the
ritual of it all.
The costuming is sensational.
The ritual of it all makes
the
it so intense.
The costuming, the hair, the makeup.
Beautiful.
And for the most whenever there's light out, Rachel Morrison,
yes.
The cinematographer, does a great job. I do think a lot of this movie is perilously underlit and sort of gnarly.
But see, when they go to Seoul, Korea, then this movie becomes like a Bond movie for like the big middle chunk. And I'm surprised how much I was really into that too, because that's where I thought it was all going to slip up. It's only in the third act where I'm just like, this movie, overstays its welcome.
Yeah, I mean, my only problem with the Bond stuff in the second act is just the CG. I mean, if they had done all the same shit, but practically,
people have seen
the car chase looks god awful. I mean, it looks really terrible.
Looks so good.
It's all plastic, and it just gets worse as it goes along. I mean, the final fight in this movie could have been rendered on Nintendo 64.
Wait,
I mean,
Katie
it's outrageous.
Dave, chime in here.
It is fucking outrageous. We will look back on these movies in 10 or 15 years and marvel, pun not kind of intended, at how we tolerated this stuff. Because it is just fucking hideous.
I don't know.
It sucks me out of the movie because it's so weightless. It's so plastic. I can tell there are no humans in there. I don't know where Michael B. Jordan and Chadwick Boseman were. They were fucking in their trailers or whatever. But like there's nothing there. And it like guts me because I was so interested. I was so involved in these characters. The action is, I don't know what Marvel is doing with the action. I don't know why they haven't been able to produce a good action sequence since the Avengers. But they're only getting worse. And I've seen Creed, and I know that Ryan Coogler can shoot the hell out of a really physical, visceral action sequence, particularly hand-to-hand stuff. And I don't know where he was in this movie, because while I do think that first fight patch is mentioned, it works overall, and it's fun to see like CG war rhinos at the end. There's one choreographed, interesting action beat in the whole movie. And it's with Danaya, what's her name?
Danaya
Gurira. It is all, and she owns it. I mean, she owns that whole sequence, throwing her wig at some, it's great. But that shot that I'm thinking of that was just like sort of graceful is all computer generated also.
The big kind of, seemingly single shot.
I mean, like Marvel has to do something if they're gonna make action movies, or please stop making action movies. You have such rich characters here. There's so much going on in Wakanda.
Previs, man, they have to start making these movies before they get directors.
It's really terrible.
I think we all want to believe that they give this movie completely to a guy like Ryan Coogler.
Yeah, but they don't.
The truth is, the final battle scene, there's a few good beats, but like,
there's good beats in the battle scene.
I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves because I want to hear, Katie, you talk a little about the beginning and middle of this movie. But by the end, it's like Black Panther is not in this movie at all, and you don't care. It's so weird how Chadwick Boseman disappears, and maybe we could talk about this in spoiler section a little bit for the reasons why this happens narratively. But like, he is a non-presence at the end of this movie, and his final fight is worthless, and it has no life to it. And I'll completely agree with David on that. It's like, it's all CG garbage, pre-viz stuff that doesn't seem like Ryan Coogler's work at all, whereas everything else before it, I really like the car chase. I really like the Bond casino
the car chase
fight
is
scene.
Cool in theory. I don't like the actual look of it, but like, it's with all the CG, but like, the sequence works, the emotional beats work, and it could have looked a lot better. But
Katie, what do you think?
Guys, we've been on so many roads.
The characters are great, but like, what is it a movie or is it just a parade?
I like the action, first of all, and the we might get into this later, but the biggest reaction in my entire audience was during that big battle scene at the end. So take that. But just to go back to the way that this world is built and kind of how it all feels to be there, the thing that it made me think mostly is that Avatar is kind of bullshit. And you all know that I have defended Avatar forever, and I'm sure that I still will. But watching this like beautifully rendered fictional place that was about not fictional people and telling a story of colonialism from the perspective of the people who are trying to avoid being colonized.
Wait, not fictional people?
No,
I mean, they're not like, they're not Na'vi.
It's about like, no, but like, yeah, it's about,
fictional people.
It's about human beings from the continent of Africa, of which many of them live, even though none of them are actually from Wakanda. Just the way that it tells a story about colonialism and the kind of like Avatar is a story about how colonialism is bad, but Black Panther takes it from just such a more human perspective, like we're talking about, and it's telling not a story about a real culture, but a story that feels real in such a specific way. And it just made me kind of think about how all of our stories about colonized people and about native cultures have just been told by white people, and how different it feels to be in a world that's like taking it from a completely opposite perspective.
Yeah, it's a far cry from The Last Samurai.
Yeah. And it really put in perspective to me when you get Martin Freeman's character, who shows up. And I had totally forgotten he was in the Marvel movies at all before this. So I think Joanna reminded me before I saw the movie. But you kind of see Wakanda through his eyes at some point. And I like that they bring him in as kind of like one of two white characters. And he's not in there as like the audience surrogate so you can understand it. But he's seeing this world and he's kind of allowing you to step back and marvel at it. And he's so genuinely interested in it. And I just I liked the way that it took the time for that. Like we were talking about the way that it feels like a world that you actually just kind of like want to wander inside. And then the way that the beginning feels kind of slow. I think I was one of those rubes who felt like it was slow in the beginning, but then it all comes back. Like the way that you're going through the entire ritual process becomes really essential to understanding where the movie goes from there. And that was just good storytelling. I was impressed by that. Dave.
Yeah.
Did you like Black Panther?
I did. I liked it a lot. I think it's going to be one of the Marvel movies that people will actually want to revisit. And I'm not talking about like people who are obsessed with Marvel movies. I'm talking about like real people.
No, this is the best Marvel movie, right? Can we all agree?
I mean, so here's the thing. This does a lot of things that are really good. It's a very good movie and it's goes, I think it does the best for Marvel from zero to hero that we've seen, assuming
he's
that,
not really from zero. Let's
I know
be clear.
You got like Captain
not at all.
America, but point
it's not
being,
an origin story.
If you
that's kind of an origin story.
If you tell me you're making an Avengers movie, if you tell me you're making a Hulk movie, if you tell me you're making a Captain America movie, if you tell me you're making an Iron Man movie, I know stories for those characters and I know what I'm expecting for it. Black Panther, they were able to just give me what they thought the character would be, and it works completely on its own, isolated from everything else, which makes it different from every single Marvel movie.
Wait, now I'm confused. Is Black Panther both a prequel and a sequel to Civil War?
No, it's a sequel.
No, only it's just the first scene takes place in the past, but after that, it's all after Civil War.
See, then it's not an origin story.
But it's about how he becomes the Black Panther.
It is,
but he wasn't Black Panther in Civil War.
An origin story. An origin story, the definition of an origin story is not nearly as strict as you're making it sound. If you if it is the story
Black Panther is not an origin story.
Okay, you know what?
Wow, this is fun.
I know, I mean, I see what he's saying because it is not, I think he confused matters by bringing the chronology into it, which I don't think is important. I think that
it's not the first movie,
it's the origin story.
No, but it's Spider-Man Homecoming is strictly a fucking origin story. That's the definition
I think
of origin
is like
story.
Strictly less about his, I mean, it's a movie about his origins, but it's not, you know, he is, I see both sides here. Both sides.
Thank you. See, I see, mean, I'm winning
it,
you
it,
over.
It
the more
ends
you talk
in the exact
it.
Same way. Well, whatever. I won't spoil
look,
anything,
the point.
It
is
doesn't
that
matter. It doesn't fucking matter.
Iron Man had to clear a shield. Thor had to get out of his own world of Asgard.
I mean, he does become the Black... I mean, no, he was the Black Panther.
Okay,
I don't know.
Stop. Stop, because I want to talk about Michael
Thank God it's not more story.
Killmonger, but we need to...
Let's do spoilers.
Spoilers. This has to be spoilers, because we also need to talk a little about the politics here.
Yeah. Oh, this is going to go great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, this is going to go very well.
Patches is... I know his angle already.
Let's talk about
which is the last line
hang
from the
on,
villain
hang
is
on.
Dumb.
Spoiler gong, Dave. You ringing the spoiler gong?
Ring.
I'll note it.
Thank
all
you.
Right, Patches. Hot take. I got my shield up.
Well, I'm not. Well, first off, I want to celebrate Michael B. Jordan in this movie, who's a great villain, who's a complicated person, and who makes really good points about his plan that is ultimately bad. Who's he's very like Magneto esque.
And it's so great that they just kill him off and get rid of all of that energy that they put so much effort into.
Yeah, I mean, he's fantastic in the movie. Does anyone disagree?
No, Michael B. Jordan crying is like the most powerful primal thing that you can see in film. He's unbelievable.
He's also ripped.
What about
I was surprised how violent this movie is.
He's crazy. I mean, none of the violence feels real when it's moving all that fast. But
I
think
multiple people in the head
on his body indicate a more real violence than anything that
like
we actually see happen on screen.
He shoots his girlfriend in the head in this movie. That's sad.
Yeah, but she's like, she literally does not have a line of dialogue, I don't think.
No,
like,
she apologizes.
No, she says, she tells her her fake worker at the cafe that she's taking a break.
Oh, that too. She apologizes. I think I shot in the head.
Should we also talk about Sterling K. Brown in the context of Michael B. Jordan? Because he was also great in a super tiny role. Proof that this cast is ridiculously stacked.
This movie has two cold opens.
Yeah, a lot of cold opens. No, Michael B. Jordan is such a great villain, and I don't want to just jump straight to the ending, but I'm really curious if anyone thinks it was, like, I just was totally expecting him to be in the next movie.
I think that would have been a betrayal of his whole character and the whole, like, isn't this movie about respecting others and understanding culture? And if Michael B. Jordan, if Killmonger asks to die a noble death because this is what he came to fight for and he lost, then the Black Panther, T'Challa, should allow him to die. I mean,
sure,
that's authentic. That's like a good thing that he died.
I mean, I don't really pay attention to what happens to Marvel villains at the end because it doesn't matter. Like, he...
David's already on his way out, so he avoids the post-credit scenes.
No, I said... I mean, the post-credit scenes in this movie are ridiculous because the first one should have been in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the first one's like an important emotional beat that should have been in the film proper, and the second one is a complete waste of time.
It's so strict.
But no, I mean, like, you know, if they really wanted to, they hit a button and he magically comes back in Infinity War along,
sure,
barely even noticing, because there'll be 900 other villains. I mean, like, you know, it doesn't really matter. But there was a real weight to his story and his arc. I think I really like the idea that he and T'Challa were, you know, at heart going after the same thing. They both wanted a bright future for Wakanda, and they wanted good things for their people, but Killmonger, who someone on the internet was joking, he's Dutch with that last name, but it's not his last name. It's a silly name, Killmonger. Always very silly.
What is his name, like Eric?
Eric Killmonger Stevens.
Chadwick Boseman on a red carpet in Korea, like, really articulately explained why the Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr. analogy is not right for these characters. It is interesting to see, like, someone who has a more benevolent approach to righting the historical wrongs that have been visited upon their people versus someone who is a little angrier and wants more violent solutions by any means necessary in a way. Again, not overruling what Chadwick Boseman was saying about why that analogy wouldn't apply. But there is really a sort of shared vision between the two of them that just splinters off in different ways. And it's not a story of good versus evil. It's a lot more complicated and more human than that. And you really get that sense sort of reverberating through all the side characters who are swept up in the fight. Although I don't know where all of the random... Do they say where all of, like, the random bad guys show up for the final fight? Like, he suddenly has an army?
That's the
Wakanda.
Wakanda. It's Daniel Kaluuya's people, because Daniel Kaluuya only a few plot points that doesn't make any sense. Daniel Kaluuya just betrays his best friend for no reason.
I think that totally makes sense.
Right?
Really?
Yes, because Daniel Kaluuya, Wakabi and T'Challa have a beat in this that really affected me, where he's like, we should go out and we should, you know, show our military strength, or that we should prove that we're a nation of worth, and T'Challa just wants to hide behind the invisible barrier that's surrounding Wakanda. I thought that was an affecting scene. You have a military hero who's, like, looking for purpose.
No, it makes like, I get
that
they have
to stay behind on
opinion.
The freaking Bond mission.
The extent of the betrayal felt a little sudden to me.
I think it's
a testament to how real I thought that his character was at first, and, like, how invested I was. Maybe I was just bringing my affection for Daniel Kaluuya, whose performance, you know, every time I watch Get Out, I'm more impressed by, to the table. But I know what he's capable of, and I know that even in a movie like this, he could take you to those places. And so for that to be not given the time that I thought it deserved, I definitely felt a little cheated. But
that was the one part of the movie where it felt like they had maybe cut something, or there had been some. I mean, this happens in every blockbuster movie, and I'm not saying that, like, it's an indication of trouble, but it felt like there was something missing there a little bit. Dave? I was going to ask if you had any insider intel, but I don't really
we could talk about whether or not his character got added more in after his performance in Get Out became talked about, and that maybe that might have changed the sexuality of one of the other characters. But I feel like there's a really good website I could read more about that.
That's Joanna's theory.
Yeah. So the basic theory is that there was
we don't have to.
At some point, an LGBTQ relationship between the Dora Milaje and they showed this to some people during set visits, including Joanne Robinson and Vanity Fair. It is not in the movie, and what was described to her as a very small part from Daniel Kaluuya has now been elevated to the lover of the Danai Gurira character, which really only comes up in a few scenes that could be very easily be done by inserts, because I don't think either of those characters is ever in a set that's out of doors, just practically. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if we got communicator scene, and then a licking rhino added in post-production. I feel like her reaction when one of her compatriots is killed by Killmonger, the final battle, is actually a leftover from that romance plot. Just because
that part convinces me, like that reaction does feel like there's a whole other story there.
Because, but like,
I will say, the
licking are dying on both sides. Why would that one person be like the huge cry moment? But they were able to massage it, and I guess the downside is we don't have that love plot anymore. The plus side is we do have more Daniel Kaluuya than I think they were planning on.
I will say that the licking rhino is what the audience I saw it with reacted to the most.
That was fun.
It was good. I like that battle scene. It felt Lord of the Ringsy. I'd so much rather have that than a fucking spaceship.
It was nice
over
to have that over, you know, like during the day, brightly lit.
Yeah.
Having the ladies fight.
And like the cloaks that become shields, and I don't know.
It's all the stuff in the mine, and I really don't understand how the plot to like activate the gliding monorail in the mine works that like deactivates their vibranium mm-hmm. vibranium,
there's a sonic frequency that,
yes but they don't really use it.
It just gives them an opportunity to talk to each other, right? I think it
I want
to
know
that's how he's able to stab him, is because it's the second before the sound turns off, so there's a hole in the Black Panther armor that allows the thing through, and then the sound stops and it seals around the wound, which is why he's allowed to stay alive as he gets dragged up to see the sunrise. So
I want a movie about Captain America needing to return his shield tearfully to its rightful home place and
to be Infinity War,
leaving the shield in Wakanda. It's better here.
See Infinity War.
Do I have to?
Yes, but I did want to mention this, and I don't know if you all will have thoughts about this, but mostly I'm interested in our listeners' reactions to this. There are a lot of politics going on in this. Well, first off, I want to say Killmonger took the seat from T'Challa, okay, in the fair way. He challenged him in the fair way and won.
Yeah.
Did he win, though?
Did the challenge end, Patches?
He did win. The challenge...
There's a very specific line in our first challenge, and then a moment where we have to see somebody, like, give up.
Yeah, you have to either concede or be killed, and neither of those things happened.
I don't know. I just feel like T'Challa.
What we
didn't
should
really
do
right
is
way.
Listen to Patches, open an investigation into Russia's meddling in the challenge.
Daniel Kaluuya will.
Wow.
That's what I keep accidentally saying. Well, that's what I heard Dave say.
Dangerous anyway. Daniel Kaluuya.
Okay. Yeah. Well, ignoring that part, I'm not dwelling on that. I just thought that was interesting
but
and kind
also,
of funny, but
like,
it doesn't really work out traditionally.
I feel like it's worth also just tackling head on, you know, because we're all so uniquely qualified to do this. Yes. What the movie has the potential, and I think the mandate
that's where I'm going
to do for black representation in Hollywood, because I mean, I think that, you know, even if the movie hadn't been the success that it is creatively, it still would have been something of a landmark moment for Hollywood, for like the dominant cinematic expression of our time for these giant superhero movies, to make a movie as overwhelmingly black as this, to be so defined and proud about it and put it out there and own it is great. But if Hollywood doesn't respond to this in a meaningful way, if they don't see this as like a call to action and heed it, like I wonder what else it could take. I mean, like if this doesn't change things, what will?
Well, I think it will. I think it will have a major impact. I think, and people can correct me if they think I'm totally off base on this, but I remember when Empire premiered on TV in 2015.
I was about to say, that was like 2 years ago. It wasn't that long.
All those years ago when Empire premiered on TV. I mean, it feels like a long time ago in fucking this world, but like when Empire premiered, I think a lot of people were blown away by the ratings. I think the premiere got like 10 million viewers or something. And I'm looking at it now. Yeah, 10 million viewers. And the finale ended with 17 million viewers. And people were going crazy. And it's like, here is an unabashedly black show about hip hop music. And wow, so many people are watching, as if, you know, Fox and Lee Daniels didn't know that there was going to be a huge audience for this show.
Well, and as if black people wouldn't turn out. Television, like that level of ratings, it's rare for any show to get that thing, especially a new one, just because TV ratings have been dropping overall.
That's what I'm saying, that when you make entertainment for an audience that wants it, they will turn out for it.
Well,
and that it's not a surprise.
Right, and nobody is.
Yes, but I also think that shows have spawned out of Empire. And I'm saying that Black Panther will have the same thing, that people will turn out, this movie's going to be huge. And
well, nobody doubts that. I mean, it's going to make crazy, crazy money. The question
is, you will see people following Marvel's tracks. Everyone follows Marvel's tracks about everything else. I think you'll see. Absolutely see.
I hope so.
Here's the devil's advocate I'm going to play to Patches's point. The Latinx community goes and sees more movies than any of you guys, and we don't have anything the size of Black Panther on the horizon, so... dollar signs don't always translate to representation. I hope we've turned the corner because, like David said, I think that everybody follows what Marvel does. And Marvel's been saying they've been going in this direction since they announced this February Black Panther movie in 2015. So I really hope it's just a case of it took a long time to go through the bullshit process. And yeah, white male patriarchy sometimes wins over best intentions, but I hope that we're all pushing in the same direction. I'm just not sure we have a similar example to point to.
But
there's the Black Widow movie coming out on March 2nd, so that's exciting.
That the one thing that I did want to say, and I had mentioned this to Katie and Dave earlier off podcast, and this is what I want more listener feedback about, because I don't know if we can answer these questions ourselves or now. But I wonder, you know, it's clear with the outpour of love. You just see people so excited for Black Panther. You see the reactions. People want this representation on screen. Everybody wants this representation on screen. And it's exciting to see it. But is there something about Marvel doing this in a way, you know, we were just talking about how Ryan Coogler he's never going to own this movie completely. He was never going to be handed the big action scenes. It's still going to be a Marvel movie. They're still going to be using the vernacular of Black Panther and what Ryan Coogler will bring to the nooks and crannies, and then still plopping in, you know, the $1 billion action scenes and the generic stuff that makes it a Marvel movie that ensures that people will come back time and time again. Do you feel that something can ever be truly authentic and that it rises above appropriation to be authentic representation on screen? Is this not product? Is this not what you detest, David, about Marvel movies?
I mean, I can't speak for the black community, but as someone who is...
Well, not... I'm not always... asking rhetorical questions here.
No, I know, but my gut instinct would be, you know, irrespective of what audience you're talking about in particular, that, yes, they can be different things. I mean, like, it may always have the stink of product on it, but if not for... I mean, if that were all that meaningful, if that diluted completely the power of seeing yourself on screen or of being told that these stories are okay and important and worth telling, then, you know, none of the movies that we think of as like the big monoliths of film culture would matter. I mean, they're all sort of product in a way. You know, it's all important. I think the thing that I like least about this movie, that it's a big old Marvel movie with all the usual Marvel crap, is also the thing that gives it its currencies culturally, and that like it's able to put these people on screen through the mechanism of a Marvel movie that everybody is going to see, that is going to be on 27 gazillion screens and is going to, you know, tie into the Marvel universe and is as like high on the totem pole as it gets. And like that is what makes it even more powerful. So you got
to. I guess what I'm thinking is that like I hope one day that Ryan Coogler gets $100 million to make his Mad Max Fury Road.
And maybe he will. And you know, maybe.
And imagine after this, he gets to do whatever he wants.
I hope so.
I mean, yeah, I certainly hope so. I hope that someone besides just Netflix is willing to give him that kind of money for a, you know, and make him do 10 episodes of something rather than making film. But we'll see.
I am Killmonger.
No one's perfect, but no one's worthless. We ain't deserving of everything heaven and earth is, but word is... good.
This is my home. No one's
perfect. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. And also coming up is the Quarter Quell, long promise. We took all of your suggestions of movies that we should watch, and we will tweet what we have settled on for each other so that you can watch along with us. We'll be recording that one in 2 weeks. So we'll be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive editor, entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And check out Thrillist this week because Dave Gonzalez is writing about some Black Panther stuff. So that'll be good. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them, leave us your Black Panther thoughts, or yeah, we want to read them. And fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm senior film critic for IndieWire. I am off to the Berlin International Film Festival tomorrow. So if you care about obscure European films, which probably won't open here, and also Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs, please follow along. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. As Patches mentioned, I'll be decoding some Black Panther for you. There will be some decoding needed. Some stuff is referenced from comic books you don't want to buy. Other than that, we do cover Black Panther on my other podcast, Storm Spoilers, at stormspoilers.com, in case you haven't tired of hearing non-Black people talk about it yet. And yeah.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, where Joanna Robinson of Stormer Spoilers is going to be writing a lot about Black Panther, as well as a lot of people. So you can read a lot about it there. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyReCH, and all of us on Twitter at FITWR, where we'd love to hear from you about Black Panther and anything else, including this week's lightning round question, which is...
In honor of Aard Animation's Early Man, what's the best work of stop-motion animation, sequence, special effect, or feature-length work?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
California nigga, and I'm heavy in these streets. If you don't keep a pole, how you ready when it's beat? Little nigga think he cut, yeah, I bet the nigga freeze. If that nigga want me dead, I can't let the nigga breathe. When we gon' send a shot like the real kind, these niggas acting like they tough when they real.